Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the University of Sussex Business School. This is part 3 of episode 51, where we're continuing to discuss The Tyranny of Light by Harriet Tsoukas. To get the text and for more information, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
A lot of the paper is dealing with the paradoxical effects of trying to capture reality or to try and understand things in terms of information. And it sort of takes a almost like a God's eye view or a systems view of the performative effects, the consequences, the unintended effects of trying to understand the world in terms of information. But now, you know, we're in a different sort of time in 2018, and I'm getting the sense that from the perspective of the people who are still being very much known in terms of their data that they're leaving behind them as they go anywhere and do anything, that from the perspective of people, there are some senses in which we don't always dislike this. So I'm going to give a little anecdote, and I understand this is contentious because we, of course, all still care about things like privacy. But a professor who I know was running a little bit of an experiment with his students, or trying to provoke them into thinking about things like privacy and trust and their data. And he did this thing where he said to the students, okay, I've now calculated your scores so far in the course, and we've gathered all this data on you, and we now can predict your final grade. This was halfway through the course, based on the data that we have. So we've used some analytics and we can now predict your outcomes. And he put on the board their student numbers with a made-up score. This was fictional. And thinking that these students would be outraged at the whole notion of, one, that their data had been gathered, and two, that it had been used to predict this outcome. But instead, the students were quite fascinated, and really the sense of outrage came from if they felt they couldn't see themselves on the board, that they weren't represented on that board, they couldn't find their student number because this was mostly made up. So the professor, when I was talking to him, was totally dismayed at this. He sort of hadn't had the effect that he had intended. But to me, it kind of makes sense. These students are so used to being known in terms of their data trails, in terms of how they're being analyzed by systems like Amazon or Netflix that are constantly recommending things to them, that it is quite comforting, perhaps, in some senses, to feel that you are understood, even if it's by an amorphous blob of technology, but that you are defined within that system. And so I want to put that forward as perhaps a counterpoint to this perspective, that things have changed and we are quite happy to be known in terms of information and to live our lives kind of looking up to those categories. What do you think?
I suspect that that's probably just an immediate reaction now, but one of the things that was going through my mind as you're talking about that anecdote is that right now the students are not in an environment where they feel threatened by that information. Would they feel a little bit differently if it was, say, their boss doing something similar with their performance rankings, in which...
See, actually...
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, no, sorry, you continue.
No, so, I mean...
But I have a counterpoint.
Yeah, but you can see where I'm going, is that the, you know, if it is something that the students are perhaps, not the students, but the individuals, something that they're basically being told that they are, I'm thinking more like musicians, who are basically put through a certain type of, or a similar sort of an exercise routinely by record companies, is they're trying to, they're promoting their individual songs or what have you, and then there are people who are basically judging it on whatever the market says, and they're essentially predicting, this is a single, that's not, and so you end up with 1,000 musicians, of which only a small handful are being even given a chance because of somebody's assessment that this is what it's going to sell. And I was thinking that, you know, there is a point where I think that the professor probably would get a reaction. It just, his particular context might not have been the right one to generate the reaction.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned performance data as well, because I, again, this is anecdotal, was chatting with some graduates and the topic of HR analytics came up. So there's this sort of promise, mainly coming from technology firms at the moment, that by collecting a lot of performance data, predictions can be made, yeah, perhaps that this employee is likely to quit soon or they're getting disengaged, and so an intervention is necessary. And actually, the main impression I got from these graduates was that they were really pleased that there might be such an intelligent system that could tip off management to when they needed extra support or help. And I mean, my impression is basically one of naivety in that situation. But I think we can't discount the trust that is present there, or at least growing up with being known in terms of data and using social media and really paying attention to how many likes you're getting and what kind of reaction you're getting online, that perhaps then you start to co-opt that form of representation as part of your own sense of self and sense of identity. And it's not such a one-way street anymore, where this is something that's done by management, by leaders to the general populace, and is more something to be co-opted. So by musicians who are on Spotify and who are being very strategic about when to release things or what kind of sound is doing well, they might get statistics for themselves and then reform their own practice to perform better in that metric. I think this is becoming more personal and less about governing bodies.
Well, one of the things that was appealing about scientific management when it was first rolled out, you know, insofar as we know, is that it allowed an impersonal evaluation and tracking of employees. And by being impersonal, it eliminated nepotism and favoritism. The same thing about bureaucracy. The Weberian bureaucracy is designed to be as impersonal as you can go within that frame of thinking. So really, I think one of the questions here is, do we value data anonymity more than being treated impersonally in the workplace? And
yeah, that's no. I,
yeah.
Well, no, I.
Why?
Zupov has talked about this in terms of a Faustian pact. You know, sell your soul to the devil. It's sort of, well, what do I get out of handing over my data? What do I get out of playing to metrics and being known in terms of data? If I get a personalized, tailored work experience where I can self-actualize in my career and sort of all these aspirational ideas, maybe that's worth it.
Right, but what if it's on the cost-benefit analysis, what if it's less about the benefit and more about the cost? What if by not giving up this data, you miss out, and that becomes the key motivating factor? It's not about gaining benefit, it's more about falling out, essentially.
Yeah, I think that's a huge issue, to not even be on the board. You know, that's the threat, that's the fear. It's not being known in terms of a reductionist set of statistics necessarily. More so, to not be included in those statistics at all is perhaps a more relevant fear today. You know, the fear of missing out seems to be quite paradigmatic. But I'm speculating here. I don't know. What do you think, Tom?
Well, I'm kind of with you on that, because I've sort of experienced things like this in a way, because my military career, I was a bit of an exception case, because I had particular skills that were a little bit unique, and so I was managed a bit differently. And in that regard, it was almost impossible for my boss to essentially evaluate me in the same way of anybody else. And I was sort of like on the periphery in terms of my functional area. And so sort of taking that and applying it to the innovators of within an organization, you know, those for whom the organization structure is mildly interesting. And the duty descriptions and all of the things we set up, upon which I immediately focus in on, if you're coming up with these ways of trying to gauge an individual's performance, you're starting from that same database problem we talked about earlier. How did you find the metrics in the first place? And how many people are not only are outside of it, but how many people don't want to be channeled according to the structure. The innovator who hasn't had the opportunity to innovate yet.
If I was going to think of a takeaway then from what we're discussing and as a sort of implication for practice, it would be exactly that I think, and many others have articulated this, that it's so important to question how these numbers are being come up with, what are the interests in presenting them in a particular way, even trying to understand how am I being represented. So to take the HR example as well, I was told by an HR professor once, you know, you will have a graph somewhere that you are placed on in terms of your potential within the organization. And that is sitting somewhere and you haven't seen it and you don't know how it was composed or what data points were used to be an input to it. And I find that very uncomfortable. So
yeah, on the one hand, there's that. But I think even if we're leaning on this paper specifically, since this is our episode, one of the implications should for sure be the ambiguity of certainty. Right. So Tsoukas wrote about the emergence of factions due to abundance of information. He wrote about the importance of action when it comes to understanding. And reading this instrumentally, what one may come up with is that there is a way and we sort of work towards finding our way as close to whatever this knowledge-based way is. But I think that would be false in terms of this particular work and in terms of a lot of what Harry wrote thereafter. Because the key thing here is, well, two that we keep coming back to is, first of all, yeah, what comes into the technology that provides the information. But the other one is that there is no right way. Like, there is no one way, there is no a way that that organizations, actions, societies, you name it, ways of thinking should converge towards, right? It's about contextual enactment of particular arrangements of information in this time and space. And in terms of thinking about this as an organizational question, much attention should be paid towards things like communities of practice, should be paid towards things like professional groups, outliers on the general organizational chart of opinions and beliefs, and even things like whistleblowers. That a lot of the stuff that we discussed on the podcast over the past 3 years, and a lot of the stuff that traditional management way of thinking tends to brush aside or combat as either disorganizing or interfering factors to successful and efficient functioning of the organization. Well, okay, that is one position, but according to a view of knowledge espoused by Tsoukas and many of his followers, it's not the only one. And recognizing the different bases for knowledge and the different actions that enact these understandings and the different arrangements that information can take place, not only in terms of how it's measured, but also in terms of how it's deployed, that actually constitutes knowledge. It constitutes the ability to derive maximum value in, well, at the time he was writing knowledge economy, but as we're continuing into the digital economy, even there, especially there, I would argue, because of the tyranny of technology that is prevalent in a digital economy, the analytics, the wearable tech, the hyper monitoring, all that sort of stuff. So being able as a decision maker in an organization to discern the different assumptions, foundations, enactments, and arrangements of information that go into all this stuff that you're being fed, I think is absolutely key to being a, you know, a knowledgeable manager or leader or whatever in the future.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And do you sort of see this then as being a warning that there are no shortcuts? This isn't a matter of we just need better technology. It's that we will always need to have space, and by that I mean kind of space for thinking, space for talking to people, space for feeling things and, you know, kind of management by walking around, but in a distributed world that might be just staying in touch with your people and working at trying to understand things. Do you think it is a kind of, we can't get rid of that, we can't automate that, there needs to be time left in a manager or decision maker's role for reflection, for thought, for connection, that you can't just say, okay, there's the dashboard for you now, act.
Well, I think that's good advice generally for any period of time. But I think another aspect of this that's important is not to delegate responsibility to tools of work, especially as they become visibly intelligent. Because, you know, thinking of what organizations are, thinking of what work is, I think it's going to be really seductive to just delegate your responsibility as an actor within that socio-material environment to a non-human actor, like a decision-making system or a, you know, an algorithm, stuff like that. And it will work and it will do the trick for sure. We've seen that, but is it going to be, it's tricky to find a word here because you don't want to say better, because then what's that mean? Is it more efficient? Absolutely, algorithms are more efficient. It's going to be more humane. You know, what does that mean? So is essentially, is it going to be the same and is it going to be sustainable? And I think that's where the slippery slope lies, that kind of delegating away responsibility to tools of work is probably not going to be the most sustainable way of running a knowledge-based organization.
And I think there's an important assumption about the trust that we place in the whole information environment. And this is probably a subject of a future episode, the impact of the information assurance issues. What impact is the ability of actors to manipulate, destroy, re-engineer the information that is out there, to steal, to do, you know, all of those, the impacts of that on not just, you know, management and the organization's ability to control its own information or, you know, to basically protect its own information, but the trust that these individuals have on the information society, such as, like, for example, Ella, the example you were giving with the students and the professor. One of the things that kind of concerns me is that as we continue to experience threats to the sanctity of the information environment, will those episodes eventually create greater and greater and greater cynicism, such that anything that's put onto a computer starts being a cause of concern? I think there are segments of society that may be going in that particular direction now. I think it's something that, as this information society that we're in continues to evolve and develop, we're going to see a little bit more of those kind of questions being asked, I believe.
Kind of sounds like so I was listening to you, sounds like what he was writing about in terms of oscillation, going from one extreme to the other. It's like, oh, let's automate and codify everything. No, that is compromising the information environment. Let's rely on word of mouth. Like, no, that's unreliable and restrictive. Let's go back to automation and total transparency. And, you know, that is a symptom of not being able to
discern
insight and understand things.
Yeah, and maybe this goes to the final point that Tsoukas makes about hubris and the warning against hubris. It's not that we have this alternative perfect way forward. It's noticing and paying attention to the limits of these ideals. And a professor of accounting, John Roberts, built on this paper in a very nice article about the global financial crisis and the limits of transparency and an ethic for intelligent accountability. And in that article, he's also arguing that we need to recognize that people have a limited capacity to give an account of themselves. There's only so much that you know about your own reasons for acting in a particular way. And if someone asks you to give an account of yourself, you're going to have to make it up to some extent, because we don't constantly act with this complete self-knowledge or self-understanding. And so the warning there is that this whole idea of transparency is also seductive, right? It pretends to be making things just merely visible, just bringing things into the light. Like it's so innocent, like it has no effects. But actually, we know through these plenty of examples that requiring transparency will change the system, will change the phenomenon. That doesn't make it automatically bad. It just means that we sort of need to be a little cautious or not so naive that just requiring everyone to report all the time or to be completely transparent in their activities, not expecting that to not have flow-on effects and being a bit mindful about those sort of interventions.
Right. So aside from being ontologically debased and possibly confused, what's the takeaway of this paper? What does it give us?
To me, this is all about reflexivity. Ask questions, think, and don't assume that you can outsource decision-making, that you can outsource judgment to a system, that people are needed and interpretation is always going to play a role and we need to be aware of that. That's for me the takeaway.
I think for me the takeaway is that Tsoukas was basically right. I mean, a lot of what he talked about in 1997 is indeed going to fruition, and that it raises a number of questions about where we go now that we're starting to see some of the dark side or the warts of an information society manifesting itself. Where do we go from here? And what do we need to be watching for?
So maybe raises questions rather than provides answers.
Yeah, but that's, I think that's the key part of it, right? It's less about knowing the answer and more about being able to ask the question.
Yeah, that's a good point. That probably sums up the article very nicely.
I suppose. I'm not sure if that's where the article went, but I guess we can.
What where did it go for you?
For me, I think it's a cautionary tale of relying too much on things we don't understand. I would venture an educated guess that most managers are thoroughly ignorant of how the information that reaches them, how it is generated, where it's coming from, how the technology that they're using to do their work, how it works, what are the things that it allows, that it restricts. And it's taken for granted. So the example with the CCTV in the operating room, mm-hmm. And CCTV on the streets and in the buses, I think is a good example of this. So it's the same technology, but its effects are context dependent on how and when it's used. And we see a lot of this, especially the techno-utopian rhetoric about organizational systems and how automation is just going to make everything so much better for in terms of efficiency, in terms of job satisfaction, you know, whatever. Okay, but how? And why? And is this really what we want? And I think this paper kind of oscillates itself between these questions. It's about what is knowledge, what is information, what are the paradoxes. And I think to me the key takeaway is to just be inherently suspicious. So my takeaway is be paranoid to an extent about your tools of work and whether what you intend to do is actually doable with what you have or what you intend to use.
Well, I was going to ask, so if you feel that a lot of people are ignorant of the way in which information is sort of packaged for them and where it comes from and how it's processed, whose fault is that, or whose responsibility is it, or where is the accountability for that? What should we be doing, or what should leaders be doing, or what should be done to counter that?
I don't think it's anyone's fault. I think it's just the consequence of the economy of knowledge that we have. We have, you know, the mm-hmm. different realities colliding and swirling together to generate whatever we see and act upon. It's I don't think it's normative in any sense, and certainly beyond control of factions or individuals. It's sort of what it is.
certain groups of people do what they do and others do what they do. It's just being, I think, cognizant of that is the case and being able to discern insight and understand how your actions are derived and how they feed into this more holistically temporal horizon of actions is important. That it's not we did this and it had no effect, or it wasn't based upon previous actions. It's more kind of being more temporally sensitive, I guess.
So I might give my own spin on this and call that curiosity rather than paranoia, but maybe that's just a matter of perspective.
Sure. Yours is better.
And that's all for episode 51. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found our conversation valuable. Please, as always, share it with your friends, colleagues, and students, and spread the word about conversations about these topics. And maybe if you think we should talk about something else, let us know via our Twitter, Facebook, or by going to our website. You can also subscribe to our newsletter there, which has lots of cool stuff coming forward, many announcements, our projects for 2019, events, conferences, other things that we'll be involved in that we would be very happy to share and participate alongside you in. Meanwhile, please join us next week as we welcome a very special guest and a dear friend onto the podcast here on Talking About Organizations.